nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
So my name is Eric Stack. I'm a professor here in the School of Materials Engineering with primary residency also in the Burke Nanotechnology Center. What I want to do today is give people a very low-level overview of transmission electron microscopy and what it can do in terms of characterization of materials. My ideal audience is someone who picks up a journal article occasionally, sees a TEM picture in there, and assumes that the people that have written about the TEM picture are right in what they've said, right? And just accepts that on faith, okay? So what I want to do is give you a sense of the different things that people can do with electron microscopy to characterize small-scale materials, overview of somewhat how the technique works, the different types of sub-techniques involved, and really hoping that you walk away with some sense of what microscopy can do generally. This kind of compresses basically two 500 and 600 level classes that I teach into an hour, and that'll give you the level of depth, right, that I'm going to go into. All right, so basic operation and a little bit about the physics of how we form images and diffraction patterns, right, and then really in each case I want to go through and talk about types of data you can obtain and the resolutions associated with different techniques. That's really just the overall ideas. What can you do? How well can you do it? And that's about it. What's a TEM? A TEM is a big microscope, all right? It's not what you're used to if you think of an optical microscope. These things are the size of the height of your room or larger. I'm showing here an old microscope I used to run at Berkeley. This is one of those press photos, so it looks nice, right? They get the fancy lights in the background. But basically, this is the microscope here with an electron source, a number of optics associated with projecting the electrons onto a sample. The sample sits within the primary imaging objective lens of the microscope. This is where all the scattering and all the physics goes on. And then we use a number of lenses thereafter to magnify it either onto a fluorescent screen or a piece of film or a TV camera or a CCD camera to take our pictures. These things have variable voltage. Voltage is used to get different amounts of interaction with the material. This is a 300 kilovolt machine here, a fairly standard machine. This one here is the first ever of the atomic resolution million volt machines, again out at my prior institution, Berkeley. And it's just nice to get the sense of scale here. This Chris Nelson, the guy who ran it, another scientist, Francis Ross, you know, it gives you a sense that these things can be fairly big and involved pieces of equipment. This machine has a 1.6 angstrom resolution. It was the first one to break the 2 angstrom barrier. This one does 1.9. but it's about 30 years younger. So there's been improvements that allow you to scale down the capabilities so that these large machines are no longer needed. Really what the TEM does is it's a transmission electron microscope, right? So it's relying on electrons penetrating into your sample and coming through all the way to the other side, right? The whole point of the TEM is to understand how electrons interact with atoms and figure out all the different things that you can learn about the atoms in the sample from that interaction, right? You can think about electron as being either a particle or a wave. The wave will come into the sample and it'll come through to the other side, and its interaction with this thin specimen will cause phase changes in the wave. It'll cause it to have a different, basically, phase as it leaves the sample, and thus you can image these differences in phase and find out something about the atomic information within the material. Highly schematic here. We'll see lots of pictures of this later in the talk. From a particle perspective, you can also think about the electron microscope working as a flux of incident particle electrons bouncing off of atoms within the sample. They can scatter in different ways, and each of these different ways can give you information about the particular atoms that they interacted with. In the case of a wave perspective, we think about that when we discuss the diffraction event. Transmission electron microscopy is revolving around diffraction, coherent interactions of the electrons with atomic arrangements of atoms in the sample, and so we build up knowledge of crystal structure from that diffraction event. We can use diffracted electrons in different ways to form images, so we can choose electrons that have diffracted to different angles to create pictures of our sample. We can also use electrons that have interacted with energy loss or inelastic scattering to again form images. And then also these energy loss events themselves give off different signals, X-rays, changes in the incident energy of the electron as it leaves the sample. These things can tell you particular which atoms the electron scattered with. So really a way to think about the microscope is it's a scattering laboratory. You're providing a source of electrons to hit a sample. All sorts of fun things happen there within the main imaging lens of the microscope. And then we have either optics or detectors to go through and probe the different scattering processes that happen. Okay? There are lots of different scattering processes that happen in the microscope, and each of these can, in fact, be used to find out something about your sample if you have the appropriate configuration in your microscope. You basically have a very thin sample, thin meaning on the order of, 100 angstroms, a couple hundred angstroms thick, right, up to as much as a micron thick, right? It has to be thin so that the electrons get through the other side. But your electrons come in with high energy, something like 100, 200, 300, or even a million volts of incident energy, and penetrate all the way through the sample. We'll have elastically scattered electrons that give us diffraction information. Inelastically scattered electrons, the electrons that interact with atoms so strongly that they lose some energy. And again, this can be used to find out spectroscopically what atoms are where. All sorts of different signals come out. We can detect characteristic X-rays, again for doing analytical work, and all of these things can tell us lots of information about the sample itself. Okay? So that's an overview of what the TEM does. It takes your material, it takes it and gives it a high flux of incident electrons. We have these electrons interact with the atoms in the sample, and all sorts of signals come out, and we use these in different ways to tell us things about the material. Okay? The primary thing that we do with the electron microscope is we do understanding of crystal structure. So when we use the microscope to do diffraction, we're relying upon simple Bragg law type scattering. The idea of having the electron wave come into the sample, diffract off of particular crystallographic planes in the material, and only at particular angles are we going to have a coherent and constructive interference pattern formed. Basically, as the electrons come in and interact with particular reflecting planes or particular orientations in the sample, if we have the correct angle, one wave One wave will have actually a given number of wavelengths more than the next, and if this angle is appropriate, at the output, this thing will have the exact same phase, and we will get constructive interference of the waves and end up having diffraction in the far field. And so these patterns that I'm showing you here are particular scattering patterns, electron diffraction patterns from different materials. And we can image these patterns, and each of these little spots that we see are associated with diffraction from particular planes in the material. And thus we can use the orientations of these spots, the distances of these spots with respect to each other, their angular interrelationships, all to allow us to find out what were the planes that were scattering, what was the spacing between the planes, and this allows us to go through and find out the specifics of the crystallography of the sample. And so, for example, in the upper right of this, we have a pattern that I took one day from gallium nitride grown on sapphire. It was a sample that was grown at a low temperature and had many, many defects in it. It was basically an example of a bad growth. And from the spot pattern that we see here, we're able to determine such things as the fact that this gallium nitride grew with a cubic crystal symmetry instead of a hexagonal crystal symmetry. We find out from the particular closely spaced streaks that are present along these lines here that it was actually twinned so that there were two cubic orientations. These long streaky lines indicate that there are small scale twins within the structure. And really this diffraction pattern tells us a lot about the microstructure itself without even imaging the sample. In the bottom right here, I've taken from the literature from Jim Zuo's work at the University of Urbana-Champaign, some scattering patterns from single-walled carbon nanotubes. And again, you're seeing particular spots indicative of scatter from particular directions within that nanotube. And here, the pattern looks much different. You see these layer lines. This is indicative of the fact that you have a helical molecule that's diffracting. And we can again go through and learn such things as the chirality of the nanotube. If we have multi-walled nanotubes, we can learn the chirality or the orientation of each of these tubes with respect to each other. And all of this can be used to give us specific information about the atomic arrangements in the sample. Right? If we have samples that are polycrystalline, not single crystalline materials, we see different patterns. We see that we have rings of intensity. This is because we have a random distribution of many orientations in the sample, and we can find out very directly from this pattern that it's a very small grain sample with many random orientations. Perhaps due to some nature of the crystal growth or processing that's occurring in the sample, we may have many small grains, but they have a relative general orientation. And in this case, we see arcs of intensity in the bottom left here, this pattern showing arcs of intensity along particular directions, indicative of the fact that there are particular crystal orientations that are common, but not strictly common in all of the sample, okay? We can also go through and look and find out that the material is perhaps amorphous. Amorphous materials are materials where the atomic structure is random, but has particular bond lengths that are favored. And so we see scattering patterns here that show a no particular spots, but we see intensities at particular directions and particular distances. And again, this indicates that we have an amorphous material with particular bond lengths prevalent in the material. And so really, with diffraction, we can find out a lot about the sample without taking any images at all. We can find out crystal structure, crystal orientation. We can find out something about defects. We can go through and find out if we have single crystalline materials, polycrystalline materials, if we have orientation to those grains, or if we have no crystal orientations or no crystal symmetries at all, have an amorphous material present, right? So that's a very overview sort of thing of what we can do with diffraction in the TEM. This is very, very powerful. And as you get more advanced in the use of the electron microscope, really the way that you use the microscope is you focus on the diffraction information first. Most of the important things about your material have to do with crystallography on first pass. And so when we use the microscope, we work hard to understand our diffraction patterns before we move further to understanding images and creating particular images of different defect structures. Now, we can use the microscope for doing imaging as well. There's different imaging modes. There's actually kind of three primary imaging modes as well as some secondary ones. The primary imaging mode that we tend to use frequently is what's called diffraction contrast imaging. And so here the idea is we're trying to find a way to image particular features in the sample where diffraction is occurring differently. I'm showing an image here of a sample of silicon germanium grown on top of silicon, a material system of great interest in the electronics field. And this is an image taken looking through a growth of silicon thin film on top of silicon. And we're seeing these black lines on a relatively flat gray background. These black lines represent particular defects in the sample. They're dislocations representing the bound between two slipped regions of a sample. And so we're able to use the microscope to find out where defects lie and their relative relationships with respect to each other. This particular type of imaging is done, again, relying on diffraction. And what we do is we take advantage of the fact that when you have a defect in the crystal, it'll strain the lattice differently and give different Bragg diffraction events. And so what we're able to do in the microscope is choose whether we image with transmitted or diffracted electrons of particular orientation. And from this, we're basically going through and mapping out in our image where do we have parts of the sample where diffraction is different. And from that, what can we learn about the types of defects that are causing this? Most cases in materials properties, it's the defects that are the important things controlling behavior. It's defects that give you plastic deformation. It's defects that allow you to create materials with particular structures and different orientations. And so when we image in this sort of a mode, we can find out about such things as dislocations, stacking faults, grain boundaries, the presence of second phase precipitates, all of the different things that one might engineer in terms of creating a microstructure of interest. And again, all of these things occur because if we have a dislocation or a grain boundary, the diffraction from these different parts of the sample is different, and thus they show up as different black lines on a white background. This can be used to great effect. It can tell you a great deal about your sample. Again, a gallium nitride on sapphire example here. This is looking in cross-section, looking at the entirety of a gallium nitride sample grown on Al2O3, and we see many, many defects occurring in the sample. We can image either the direct beam or the diffracted beam, and in each case we see complementary information. We see different small granularity in the sample. It's very common in this gallium nitride system that you have very small misorientations occurring, and those show up as long columnar type grains within the sample. We see many defects occurring in this, and this tells us that we have a highly defective structure, and this has impact on the electronic properties. There's other ways that we can do this to increase the resolution. This is called a weak beam image. We do some tricks to look at particular diffracted vectors. We see very thin white lines, each of these representing individual defects. We can find out lots about their conformation and interaction. We can see very small events where they interact with each other, causing them to bend, causing them to recombine, and reduce the net density of dislocations in the system. So, again, examples of this all through the system here. This is used very, very frequently throughout material science, not only in semiconducting materials, but also in more conventional metallurgical work. I show these examples. They're sort of standard-looking things. Many tangles of dislocations occurring in something where there is a particular plastic deformation event. We're seeing slip where one section of a crystal moved with respect to each other through the transmission of these dislocations along a given line. All sorts of different defects and patterns can form. This is from a piece of metal that was bent and frequently rolled in the same direction. You're seeing the different crystalline grains and high amounts of deformation occurring in the material. And so diffraction contrast is really used to allow us to image defects within a material. And again, in terms of nanostructured materials, in terms of things like nanowires or nanoparticles, these same things occur. We can have stacking faults often occurring within the growth of indium arsenide or gallium arsenide type nanowires. And again, we can use the transmission electron microscope to image those defects within the sample. Another imaging mode that we have within the TEM is called phase contrast or high resolution TEM. In this case, instead of choosing just one particular wave as it exits the sample, we interact all of the waves and form an interference pattern. And so a very simplified idea of how this works is we have a very thin sample, and our incident electron wave is brought to the sample, scattering occurs within the material, and we have these transmitted and diffracted waves that come on the way out. Okay? In this case, in the TEM high-resolution mode, the sample has to be very, very thin, on the order of 10 or 15 atomic levels thick, 100 angstroms or so in thickness. And so what will happen is the wave will come in, it'll come out the other side with a phase shift due to this interaction. We'll have the presence of different diffracted waves coming out to different Bragg angles, right? And in the far field, if we take and look at the interference pattern that's formed by the transmitted and the many diffracted waves, in the far field we will see an interference pattern that allows us to do atomic level resolution of imaging, right? This is a picture taken from Uli Dahman out at the Berkeley lab. Here we're looking at little white dots here. Each of these white dots are individual atomic columns of aluminum diffracting the electron wave. We're collecting both the transmitted and all of the diffracted waves together to allow us to form an interference pattern which redepicts basically where the atomic positions are in the sample. This is an image taken again of aluminum with two grain orientations and a big lead precipitate in the middle. And you see very complex patterns forming in different regions of the sample. We see that the orientation of the atomic structure here versus here is different. These things meet at a particular angle at the grain boundary. We see an overlay of information from an embedded precipitate within this grain. All of these things can be used to tell us about the crystal structure, the crystal orientation, as well as interrelationships between different phases of the material. These images are taken at levels of resolution that are really quite astounding. The best microscopes to date can get down into the 0.7 to 0.8 regime in terms of angstrom. The size of an atom is on the order of 0.3 to 0.5 in its breadth in terms of how it interacts with an incident electron. So we're getting down to the point where we can image at atomic resolutions in almost any material in almost any direction. And this is really an astounding capability, and I think one that will revolutionize our ability to characterize materials. Again, a couple of very pretty examples of this just because I have them. This is, again, taken from a gallium nitride on sapphire system. You can see that this is a material system I've worked on a lot because most of my examples come from this. But again, here we're looking at that same sort of a material I showed earlier. I was showing, looking at this sample here in a diffraction contrast mode, right, where this distance here is about 7 microns with different defects prevalent in the material. If we go through and look right here at the interface between the sapphire and the gallium nitride, we can zoom up the magnification of the microscope and look at the atomic structure of just that interface. And that's what this image is here. And we're seeing, again, white dots present where there are gallium atoms. The nitrogen atoms are not showing quite clearly here, but they can be imaged with a little bit more clarity at higher levels of magnification. We see the interface with the underlying sapphire growth substrate. Again, it's individual atomic atoms present as structure that diffract the electrons and give us features, white blobs in the image. I like this image for a number of reasons. One of the best ones is we can see that at the interface between the gallium nitride and the sapphire, the crystal structure becomes a bit diffuse, right? We don't see real sharp interface here between the growth of the gallium nitride and the sapphire. We see a lot of diffusivity at that interface. And the reason for this is actually within the projection of the sample, there's a number of dislocations and defects that are accommodating the large difference in lattice parameter between the underlying growth substrate and the overlying gallium nitride. If we follow a given trace horizontally from one row of atoms in the aluminum oxide all the way up, you can see that the gallium nitride templates fairly generally on that, right? You can see it goes generally in the same growth direction. But if you look really carefully, you'll see that there's some distortion in that. And again, that's the accommodation of misfit strain between the gallium nitride and the sapphire. All of these things showing up very clearly in these images. In the case of nanostructured materials, people use this very, very often as a way in nanoscience to say that they have single crystalline materials. Again, if you're frequently reading the literature of the nanowire growth community, it's almost necessary when publishing a paper in that field to have a high-resolution TEM image of your sample indicating that it is single crystal. Right? People like these. You say, oh, look, it's beautiful, right? Nice white atom positions showing that we have a single crystalline region of the sample. In fact, you really want to do this with electron diffraction because the diffraction pattern is able to characterize a much larger area. And so although people tend to produce these types of images as a way to talk about crystallinity, the diffraction pattern is a superior one. But I'm putting this out here basically as a way for you all to understand how you might use high resolution in nanoscience as a way to characterize crystal structure, prove things that are single crystalline within a given regime, and look at things, defects along the lengths of different, defects of different interfaces in materials. Another thing that people do for high resolution imaging, here I'm showing some high resolution images from some extraordinarily small germanium nanoparticles, right? Here we're having particles that are as small as, goodness, what, 2 to 3 nanometers in size. Unfortunately, my reproduction's not showing up very well. This one's a little bit better. You can see some of the atomic planes here, and it's possible to actually go through and use computational methods to extract out diffraction patterns from these atomic planes and use this to characterize crystal structure. And in fact, in this work, we're finding that these small germanium particles are having a phase that's unexpected, a tetragonal phase that they would normally not have. And again, high-resolution imaging allows you to do this sort of work. It allows you to take pictures not only the size, shape, conformation of these things, but also the diffraction and underlying crystal structure from them. Interestingly here, too, you can see that there's a change in the orientations of the atomic lattice there. It turns out that this structure is multiply twinned and thus defective, and that would, again, have an impact on the electronic and optical properties of this material. Okay? So all sorts of things that we can find out from high-resolution imaging. It's also possible to use this scattering laboratory of the TEM to find analytical signals, to find out things about which atoms are where in the sample. We can go through and detect the X-rays that come off from the scattering event. You'll recall that I mentioned that one of the things that can happen is that we can have characteristic X-rays that come out of the sample due to the interaction with the atom. The reason this happens is the incident electrons can actually knock inner shell electrons off of a given atom, and when this happens, outer shell electrons will transition down to lower the energy state in the sample and give off a characteristic X-ray with an energy that's equal to the difference in the atomic shells. And so you can use the energy of this X-ray as a fingerprint of what atoms were in the sample interacting with the incident electron beam. And so we will basically take a detector that sits near our sample and counts the X-ray counts at a given energy. And here you see a spectrum showing that there's a lot of intensity of X-rays at this given energy and a lot more here. And just from known tables, we can find out that this means we have both oxygen and aluminum in the sample. The thing that's nice about this in particular is that because of the fact that electrons are very small, we can actually focus our electron source down to being a very small probe, on the order of a couple of angstroms or so in size. And so we're able to determine specific chemistry from very, very small volumes of material in a way that basically no other technique in the world can. The ability to focus down to very small probe sizes is something that's improving dramatically with each new generation of microscope, and we're really getting down on the order of single angstrom sort of scale in terms of doing spectroscopies in the material. Also, you can do electron energy loss spectroscopy. When the electron comes in and causes this characteristic X-ray emission, it loses some of its energy. The scattering process steals some electron energy, and on the other side of the sample, it has less than it came in with. We have another type of spectrometer we can just mount to the bottom of the TEM, right, that allows us to disperse the electrons by the amount of energy that they have lost. And again, look at a spectrum, and from the individual points where these intensity peaks occur, we can find out what material is present in the sample. Whenever we have energy losses at 528 EV, we know that there must have been oxygen in the material that was causing that particular energy loss. Again, we can do this on the order of individual angstroms of spatial resolution. We can do this with spatial resolutions on the order of 1 EV. All of these things allow us to tell very specifically what atoms are where. Even more interestingly, with EELS, electron energy loss spectroscopy, the shape of these edges has particular meaning, and it actually probes the density of available states for the electrons to scatter into. And so as a result, electron energy loss spectroscopy tells us even more than what atoms are there. It also can be used to tell us their bonding configuration. An example of this is in the next slide. I've stolen some slides from a fellow who was looking at bonding configuration, in particular boundaries between titanium oxide. He was creating boundaries of two crystalline grains of titanium oxide with small angular misorientations. And he was curious, what's the bonding across that boundary? And so what he was able to do was to go through and find out the signature or shape of these energy losses, and then go to known oxide structures with known stoichiometries of the titanium and oxygen, and find out that his samples at this boundary had a fingerprint signature that was closest to the TiO2 type, and thus he had a four-fold coordination of the titanium atoms at the boundary. Again, pretty impressive level of specificity, right? Finding out the boundary orientations and finding out in particular what's the bonding across the boundary in a sample. We can also go through and use the same spectrometer to allow us to image electrons that have lost a particular energy. Here I'm showing a map taken using only silicon electrons. In other words, I have a sample here that's a silicon substrate grown with multiple layers of silicon germanium. This is exactly what you would have in a modern-day device that's using strained layer silicon for its active transistor element. And so you're having here a substrate of silicon and then increasing amounts of germanium incorporated into the sample, right? We're selectively imaging the electrons that have only interacted with silicon atoms. And so we see as we go thicker and thicker in the sample, we get dimmer and dimmer in terms of intensity. And this indicates that the top layers have less silicon than the bottom, and we can go through and correlate this quantitatively. Interestingly, we again can do this at very high levels of spatial resolution. This is a story I like to tell. I got this sample from a friend at a corporation that was working on this, and we were using this as a test sample to look at a new spectrometer. And so we made a very nice sample. We flew to Germany to look at the spectrometer performance. And when I came back, I told the fellow, I said, I don't know if you realize this or not, but you've got a layer of silicon in between each of these individual layers. If you look, there's a bright white line in between each of the different sections. And that bright line's on the order of a nanometer in size, maybe a little bit less, and indicative of maybe three or four atomic layers of silicon that were grown during the process. And the fellow said to me, oh my goodness, there's no way I expected you to see that. You're not supposed to know that. That's one of our tricks in the growth of these things. And so please don't ever publish these images, right? So now I'm publishing them, right? I've talked to him since. This is now old hat. It's 15 years old. But at the time, it was kind of interesting that you could do this and see this level of resolution. So again, we're able to map out local chemistry in a single image, finding out which atoms are where and where they exist across spatial distribution in a solid. Okay? Now, those are the primary sorts of things that we can do imaging-wise and spectroscopy-wise. It's also worth talking about dynamic experiments. We can take pictures, we can take diffraction patterns, but importantly, we can also find ways of manipulating the sample and doing different things to the sample and imaging the results of these in the microscope. Here I'm showing a couple of very quick images taken from some work, again, that I was involved with John Cummings. Here this is a single carbon nanotube, multi-walled carbon nanotube, and these folks have constructed an apparatus inside the TEM that lets us do field emission. And so they vary the field emission voltage, and using a particular imaging mode, they can actually map out the relative field distribution around the sample. And so this is a dynamic experiment allowing us through electron holography to map out spatial distribution of electric fields in a sample. Very sophisticated stuff, right? I just show these very quickly. There's lots to this. This is not something you'll do without a lot of work, but just to give you a sense of the different types of things that can occur. Dynamical behavior, there's lots of things that people have done. They've found lots of different ways to probe and alter samples in the microscope. High temperatures, low temperatures, the presence of chemical flux. The idea of going in and bending and poking at materials is something that's becoming increasingly of interest. Going through and applying electrical bias to materials to find out how large amounts of electrical flux can interact with and cause local changes in a sample. Again, an example taken from the work of Cummings with a holder that I helped them build some, and we were there looking at how carbon nanotubes interact. If you go through and pull on them, they'll actually go through and telescope back and forth. Again, very nice work from the Cummings and Zettel group a number of years back. All of this done dynamically, taking video images of the process and trying to find out what happened. Here at the Birx Center, we're really focusing on that sort of work, but we have a microscope that's very unusual in that we're able to probe the interaction of materials with gases. So we're actually able to open up a valve and flow gases in on the sample, which allows us to do such things as crystal growth, catalysis, and oxidation type of experiments, all combining things like high levels of resolution and chemical specificity. I'll show you some examples of that sort of work real quick. This is taken from the literature from another equivalent microscope, looking at the nucleation and growth of carbon nanotubes. Here a small catalyst particle is being used to nucleate multiple walled nanotubes. And if you look carefully at the images at higher magnification, of course, these folks were able to show the particular steps in the catalyst were correlated with the nucleation of particular multi-walled nanotubes. We're also doing work locally. Basically, we're able to go through and look at these processes such as nucleation and growth in real time. The video on the right shows small catalyst particles of gold, the influx of silane onto the sample, and what you see as the time proceeds in the video is little small white dots associated with the nucleation of silicon nanowires, and we're able to quantitatively measure their nucleation kinetics and watch their growth. And from this back out importance, things about the thermodynamics of the nucleation and growth process in the material. Okay, so that's kind of the sort of things I wanted to talk about in the TEM, about imaging, about diffraction, and the like. There's one final thing that I want to go over about transmission electron microscopy, and that's a final imaging mode and spectroscopy mode called scanning transmission electron microscopy. In this case, we're using the electron source and the scattering laboratory a bit differently. Instead of taking a dispersed electron wave and having it pass through the sample, we deliberately take the electrons and we focus them down to a very, very small probe. The idea there is that we have this very small probe, and if it's of an appropriately small size, we can scan it back and forth across the sample and have it interact with the individual atomic columns, giving scattering and again forming images. So the probe size in this case has to be on the order of the atomic columns themselves. Something on the order of 2 angstrom or less is needed. Most machines will get to 1.4 angstrom or so of the newer machines, with resolutions down in the 0.7 or so having been achieved. And so you take this little probe, you place it on an atomic column, and you scan the thing back and forth. And at each point, wherever it hits an atom, it scatters, and we use a detector to collect that scatter, and we form, again, atomic-level resolution images of the patterns that occur, from this scattering laboratory in the microscope. These images are also particularly interesting because it turns out that to these high angles that we collect, the scattering is dependent on the atomic number or the atomic weight that's present in the atomic column. And so we see here, not only do we see atomic level of resolution where each of these dots represents columns of atoms in the sample, we see that there's a systematic white, dim pattern. And that's because this was taken from something called strontium titanium oxide, and the strontium's heavy, and the light ones are titanium, right? And so we're able to, by row, determine what the chemistry of the atomic columns are. And this is, again, showing a boundary between two crystalline grains, and with some careful work, you can find out about which atoms sit where at the boundary using this type of a spectroscopy. Interestingly, because we collect this only to high angle, the directly scattered electrons are still able to be detected by our EEL spectrometer. And so we're able to go through and not only form images that tell us about the chemistry, but also extract out these electron energy loss spectroscopy and look at differences in bonding state. This is a very, very powerful technique and something we do have the capability of doing here at Purdue at a reasonable level. You can form really beautiful images depending on what type of scattering angles you collect. You can either collect the central beam, low angles, or high angles. And again, each of these different types of patterns tell you about where the different atoms are within the sample. And again, with each of these things, you can go through and probe locally the spectroscopy and find out a bit more about the grain boundaries. I have a blow-up of that one same strontium titanate boundary, a little bit better imaging conditions, again, from Nigel Browning's work. And again, you can see very clearly patterns that are forming at the boundary with different types of atoms located in each place. Some of the real beautiful work done lately, this was some work done by Ilka Arslan using the best microscope basically in the world for this, existing in England. And again, looking at dislocation cores, this is actually a given defect structure in gallium nitride and another different one over here, and finding out small changes in bonding configuration along defects by pacing the probe at the defect site and looking at how the different spectra give different indications of bonding within the material. Very nice stuff, and I was fortunate to be involved in some aspects of that. Another very beautiful example of this STEM technique, again taken from the work of Dave Muller, is showing individual vacancy and defect clusters. Here they were imaging antimony atoms in silicon and showing individual and vacancy and interstitial clusters of antimony in this images here, the bright dots being the antimony, and they worked through and showed that these are individual atoms that are scattering differently, right? So individual point defects able to be imaged in this mode, okay? And so what I wanted to do basically was just to give everyone an overview of what the TEM can do, right? It's able to characterize crystal structure, crystal chemistry, crystal bonding, and do all of these things dynamically. It utilizes electron diffraction, diffraction contrast imaging, and various high-resolution imaging modes for this sort of characterization. And it's an overview of the different capabilities. I guess the final thing to say in conclusion is that each of these things represents a reasonable amount of work. It's not something that you start off and say, oh, I'd like to do atomic level spectroscopy of this defect structure and anticipate doing it in a week or so. It's a pretty complicated technique. The microscope's complicated in terms of its operation. But this is all feasible, and I guess for the NanoHub folks and the folks in the audience, I wanted to just give you senses of how you could use this tool so you can think about it in your own research and then ponder whether or not the effort needed is useful for your work. Okay? And so with that, I'll close and take any questions. Do we have any questions? Yes, sir. Yes. I didn't get into the samples. The question was, is doing TEM destructive on the sample? The answer is very much so. Very, very much so. Unless your sample's already very thin. Okay? The TEM is an interesting thing. The electrons that you're using scatter very easily with atoms, right? An electron's a little small charged particle. An atom has a big charged core and an electron cloud. The electrons will scatter with either the atomic core or the electron cloud. It does so pretty easily. And as a result, if you have 7,000 atoms along the length of it, the electrons will scatter not once, but many, many, many times, and you'll collect nothing at the other side. So your sample has to be thin. The thinner and the better in most cases, right? And so if you have something like a gallium nitride on sapphire, you've got to go through a fair amount of work to make it thin, right? And there's a lot in that. It takes you several weeks to learn how to do that, and then it's tedious to do. If you're fortunate, like our friend in the audience here, Placidus, who looks at carbon nanotubes, right, those things are already very thin, right? They're a single sheet of graphene that's wrapped around ourselves. You plop them on top of a support membrane, you stick them in the microscope, and you go, okay? Same with nanowires and nanoparticles. Those sample preparation methods are much easier because the sample's already thin. The TEM is playing, I think, a very large role in nanoscience, largely because of all the capabilities I mentioned, but also because it's a lot easier to look at nano stuff, okay? You know, in metallurgy, we've been using the TEM for many years, and most of the advances in metallurgy have had at least some, you know, TEM has had at least some impact on them. But all that sample preparation is difficult and timely, time-consuming and the like. But the TEM is really useful in the nano world because the sample preparation is easier, and it's easier to get on the microscope and start to learn to use it and do things with it. So if you have small particles, not necessarily destructive, but you won't be pulling them out to do anything else with them. Yes, Mark.
So I'm someone who's not a TEM expert, but a sample cell to extract.
Yeah, it's a great question.
Is there a user facility or do you need to talk about it?
So I'll do this in this way. If you look at this piece of equipment, it's not cheap, right? One quick look at this tells you this is not a cheap piece of equipment. One of these guys will cost between $500,000 to the newest high voltage ones. I heard a quote of something like $40 million for the one built in Japan that was a field emission scope. Okay, as a result, they are user facilities in every case. I know of one person who has her own microscope. Okay, and that's at a central research lab. Okay, and I really wish I were that person. So these things are always in user facilities, and there are always multiple projects going on. The role of someone who runs a TEM facility like myself is to make sure that there are lots of users to help pay for things, right? We have to spend lots of money to keep this thing up and running. A service contract on one of these machines will vary from between as little as $30,000 a year to as much as $250,000 or so, depending on all the bells and whistles you have. And so hourly rates are charged, and people, you know, all work together to pay for that every year. So my job is to make sure that I give talks like this to maybe find two or three new users, right, who say, oh, yeah, I want to do this, right, take some classes to learn how to, and then become part of the crowd that helps pay for it all so I can do the fun things I like to do. And that's the honest-to-God truth of it. If you are in a situation where you've got, you know, so Placidus has been growing, you know, PECVD nanotubes, and man, he says, oh, I think I've found it. I've got a great way to create you know, semiconducting nanotubes every time, single-walled nanotubes. Placidus says to me this and says, I need a picture, right? And we do that, right? If you need one picture or two or three pictures, we tend to have the ability to do that with you. That's me, my students. We have a staff scientist at Burke, Dmitry Zakharov, who's incredibly talented, who's able to take couples of pictures, right? We had an example in indium arsenide nanowires with Dave James's group, right? So we've got a couple pictures. And boy, they look at those pictures and they say, this is pretty useful, right? And the next thing that happens is the fellow trains, right, so that he can get his own, and that can be part of the research effort. And so we tend to do this in a way where we get first pictures for people to get them excited and then get them involved, right? Because it is complicated. And, you know, I run SEMs and could give an equivalent talk on the SEM. It would be much shorter. There's a lot less you can do with an SEM, and we can get people trained on an SEM quite quickly, right? It's a much easier thing to do. But the TEM is much more complicated, and so you tend to help people decide whether or not it's really necessary and useful. And if so, we do it. Yes, sir?
You talked about the thickness.
Yeah.
The sample size, area-wise, minimum and maximum.
Yeah, the samples are 3 millimeter disc size, that's the maximum, and there's all sorts of different answers on minimum, okay? It depends on what you're looking at and how you're doing it. The reason for that maximum is the objective lens that you're using is a magnetic lens. it's a magnetic lens that's being used to shape the electrons as they go through, right, and focus them. And you need a pretty strong magnetic lens when you're dealing with very energetic electrons. So we have many tesla of magnetic field. And it's hard to get a beautifully shaped magnetic field at that sort of level. And so our poles that we use, the objective lens is one that has a 5 millimeter dual pole thing, right? And that gap gets really, really small so we can shape the field nicely, right? And so that's what minimizes our sample size. If you have the ultimate and high resolution microscope, that'll be about a millimeter and a quarter or a millimeter and a half or something, right? So your sample is sticking in there 3 millimeters wide and you can't do much tilting even, right? Most cases, people open up that gap so they can do more to the sample and trade off some resolution. But it's about a 3 millimeter size maximum. Yes, sir, in the back?
What is the image capture rate?
Ah, great question. Poor. It's really bad. The fastest is 30 frames a second video rate, right? So there's cameras you can buy that are just an intensified. You use a scintillator to hit a thing to convert the electrons into photons, and then use that and image that at 30 frames a second, which is terrible. I just bought a new camera for my microscope that'll do onto a CCD, which is nice, much better, higher quality at 15 frames a second at 1K by 1K. So I'm pretty excited about that. Now that's terrible, right? Because a lot of physical processes happen much, much quicker than that. And that is a major problem with dynamic imaging and use of this in the field. There is a project ongoing at the Lawrence Livermore Lab where they're building a pulsed source TEM. This is an interesting project. They're using an old TEM. They drilled a hole in the side of it, and they're using a laser to come in and knock off electrons off of a tungsten, I think, source. And those electrons then come down the column in a packet. And then they time stroboscopically the images from there. And they've gotten diffraction information down into the 30 nanosecond regime, and they're working on making that an imaging machine with variable imaging rates. And that's a very large project that, like, only a national lab can really do, especially a national lab that's very good with lasers. But that's, I think, a big development in the field, and I anticipate that the next microscope I buy will be one of those 10 to 15 years from now. Yes, Placidus.
TEM has already been used to establish a correlation between the size of the particle size and the differential diameter of carbon nanotubes.
Correct.
I was wondering if the TEM we have here has the capability of actually helping us to investigate those factors or those conditions that actually determine the chirality. So can we carry out in situ studies to actually, you know, monitor the nucleation process of carbon nanotubes to have more insight into those conditions or the chemistry involved?
Yes. Understood. Yeah, I mean, it's an important question. And you know, it would, my answer here would be hoping that the NSF program manager I write this grant to is listening. Yes, it's an extremely important question, and in fact, this microscope can do that, right? But basically, you need to have a source of carbon, right, in around your sample. You need to have a catalyst that needs to be hot. So you can do these sorts of things if you have appropriate facilities for putting gas in on the sample. Yesterday, we were using the microscope and getting images of graphite sheets, test images, sort of to get used to this, at 800 Celsius with 3.4 angstrom, no problem. Okay? That's pretty nice. So I think it's, yes, possible to do some of these correlations in real time. But not simple. Right? It's interesting. So as I say, we got 3.4 angstrom sort of images yesterday at 800 Celsius, but that was after an hour and a half of waiting for things to stabilize. So, you know, none of it's simple. But crystal growth is one of the things that there are more people doing. There's a number of microscopes around the world focusing on that these days. Yes, sir.
What's the difference between the image that you guys are receiving by being bombarded by these electrons versus the true image that you'd see if you didn't have any effects?
That's a great question. So, right, it is a high energy flux of particles onto the sample. And so you can have beam damage. There's no question about it. It could be that the electron comes in with such energy that it sees an atom and knocks it off the lattice site, right? It could be such that if you have a given bonding configuration and you knock an electron out, then the bonding configuration's changed. And so damage is something that we really do worry about, and there are tables and studies and knowledge of different materials and their damaging thresholds and damaging rates. So when you use the microscope, you have to be cautious of this and aware of that on your particular material. And it varies from material to material. At like for aluminum, it's 170 kV and above, you have problems with this the atoms getting knocked off. In silicon, it's 190 kV and above. In carbon nanotubes, it's 95 EV and above, right? So in each material, it just depends what's the situation. It also is not a linear function. So in fact, for biological materials, there's some reason to go to very high voltages. And that's because as the voltage goes up, the electron velocity goes up, the probability of interacting goes down, right? And so you can actually get less beam damage at very high voltages than at low voltages. And again, that depends on the material and the specifics. So it's a very complicated sort of question to answer. But it's a big problem, and you have to convince yourself that it's not something that's affecting what you see. Now, in terms of, is that the question you were asking? I think, okay, because there's one other way to interpret your question is you know, what's going on with the electrons in the solid themselves. And there, all you're really doing is saying, look, I've got an electron, and I'm putting it in a material with a given potential, right? How does it interact with that potential in the material? And that's a quantum mechanical calculation that you can do and figure out to find out what happens to the electron on the way through and out the other side. So, yes, Wayne.
How do you prepare a sample that's only a few atoms thick, and how do you
measure it? Carefully. No, so it depends. So if you're looking at a metal, what you'll do is you'll basically use a system that will allow you to do controlled corrosion, electrochemistry, right? So you pick a solution and drop a current across the sample and find a nice sweet spot where you corrode the sample very nicely until you poke a hole, and then right around the hole things are thin. If you're looking at semiconductor materials, you use argon ion atoms to sputter away and, again, make a hole and look around the thin part. You can use a machine called a focused ion beam microscope for doing this site specifically. That's a whole other kind of talk. That's used a lot in the semiconductor device industry for looking at failed devices. Again, we have one of those at Berk for doing this sort of thing as well as other things. It's an art, and basically, as I teach my class, I give like one lecture on sample prep, but I could give a semester on sample prep of each of the different types of techniques, but it's only relevant to your sample, right? I mean, every sample is different. And so there's a bit of a buildup of knowledge amongst the community on how to do different things. How do you measure it? It's interesting. In short, a really short answer to that is, this pattern that I see as a high-resolution image is, in fact, a measurement of that in some ways. We use the microscope and focus it in a particular step of defocus, a particular focus condition, right? And the pattern that we get from the wave interference looks like something. And if the sample's thicker or thinner, then there will be different phase shifts of the transmitted and diffracted waves, and so the pattern will be different. Okay, and so, see this down the very bottom right-hand corner, there's that little inset there? This is the correct way to show these images. This is the picture, and this is the simulated image, right, based on a known defocal step and a known thickness of the sample, right? And so what the person who's doing this is saying is, not only did I take this picture, but I understand it, right? It was a sample that was so thick and imaged in the following way. And so from that and some careful simulation work, you can find out literally the exact thickness of the sample. With really good images, you can find out how many exact numbers of atom layer thick. You can actually find out if there's missing atoms and things like that with some real work. Okay. In the bulk type of samples, it's a little bit different. If you're looking at something like this, right, that top one, you can say, well, this is a 111 slip plane in aluminum, right? And so I'm looking at it from this angle, use the diffraction pattern to say the crystal orientation and do a projection and say, well, that's about a micron and a half thick or something. You know, so it depends on what you're doing. you can also use information from the diffraction pattern itself in a certain mode. So, but it is an important problem, right? Because if you're going to report a dislocation density in this sample, it's a two-dimensional image, right? So you can give an aerial density, but you really want to know a volume density. And so you need to know that, that Z dimension as well. And again, something you have to answer.
So you have an example of the hole in the middle.
Yeah, oh yeah. Yeah, you always have a hole in the middle. Which is actually useful for alignment purposes, but anyway. Okay. Well, thanks for attending. And if you are interested in any of this, give me a call. And that goes to the NanoHub people, too. I'm here to educate near and abroad, right? So my information will be on the talk.